Good morning and welcome. I think somebody should be selling popcorn. We seem to have attracted a crowd this morning. Peanuts, Cracker Jacks. Maybe that was last year's stadium bill instead. Members, we have this morning our first bill hearing, House File 131, and Representative Hillstrom is here to present that along with Vice Chair Representative Benson. After we complete that bill, we will be introducing and spending a little time with two of the House researchers that were assigned to this committee and giving the committee a better handle on the work that they do and the resources that they are for members and for the public. With that, good morning, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm Representative Deborah Hillstrom, and I do apologize right when I start. I'm going to be leaving here in about 2 minutes to catch a flight, and so Representative Benson will be presenting the bill on my behalf with the assistance of the Attorney General's office. So with that, this is the Social Security Numbers Bill, and it does restrictions, and I want you all to know that we've been working very hard with the stakeholders to try to come to some compromise.
Didn't mean to cut you off. Representative Hillstrom. Representative Benson, would you please move the bill so that it's before the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I move that Representative Hillstrom's bill, House File 131, be recommended to pass.
And sent, I believe, to the Committee on Commerce and Labor?
Yes.
Thank you very much, Representative Benson. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so we've been working very hard with all the stakeholders, and we do have an amendment that I think goes a long way to addressing their concerns. And so if you'd like to have Representative Benson move that amendment, that would be great.
Representative Benson.
I do so move that amendment.
Okay, that's the A07-005 amendment.
That is correct.
Representative Hillstrom, this is the author's amendment to get the bill in the order you prefer?
Correct.
All right. Members, it's in your packet. All those in favor of the amendment, please answer aye.
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 All those opposed? Thank you very much. Representative Hillstrom.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that, I am going to ask Representative Benson and the Attorney General's office to continue with the presentation, and I would encourage you all to support this bill. Again, it is a process that we've been going through in a very cooperative manner, and I think that process will continue.
Marvelous. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill, which was discussed in a different form and passed 2 years ago, has come up again because of concerns having to do with whether or not organizations that had practiced the use of the Social Security number needed correction. And as we all know, whenever technology changes as rapidly as it does in our present age, unintended consequences result. And one of them has been a reliance on the use of Social Security numbers for all kinds of legitimate purposes in government and commerce. But the result, in many cases, has been a growing problem having to do with identity theft. Last year, according to Forbes magazine, over 9 million identity thefts throughout the United States took place. And according to statistics here in the state of Minnesota, over 3,000 identity thefts have taken place. And it seems incumbent upon us as representatives of the people here that we deal with this issue at the level that we're able here at the state level. And so that is the reason for this particular bill being introduced. Earlier in the week, Representative Hillstrom and I and representatives from the Attorney General's office met with a number of groups interested in this bill, and we discussed concerns they had. And the amendment, which was just passed, has been designed to meet, I think, many of those concerns. And this is an important bill, and I'm pleased to see that the Attorney General's office under Attorney General Swanson is taking interest in this area of the law, an area of law that needs to be looked at more carefully and dealt with. So what I would like to do at this point is turn over the discussion to Mr. Ireland from the Attorney General's office to discuss some concerns that were raised in an earlier meeting and to discuss the changes that have been made and a couple of other items that I pointed out to him this morning concerning the use of the word encryption, and also the concern that one group indicated on the second page, a clause which had been eliminated, marked clauses 1 and 5, the Social Security numbers be included. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will turn it over to Mr. Ireland.
Thank you, Representative Benson. Mr. Ireland, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Ireland. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Consumer Enforcement Division. I worked in the Consumer Enforcement Division since 1999 and been fairly active in the areas of privacy and consumer fraud, and currently serve on the National Association of Attorneys General Task Force on Privacy and Identity Theft. As a quick way of summary, we have a current law that has two parts. It's 325B59 Subdivision 1, which has a list of prohibited activities. And then we have Part 2 that has a large loophole that allows people to continue activities that would be prohibited under Part 1, provided that they start before July 1st of 2007. And so this amendment is the first item of the amendment before this committee, is to repeal that loophole. We need to create an even playing field, and it just simply doesn't make sense for someone who has already is conducting business to continue to do that business indefinitely when it violates the act, whereas someone 2 years or 3 years down the line who is doing that exact same conduct would be in violation of the law. So that's the first item. The second is in subpart 8 is a provision that restricts and prohibits the sale, lease, loan, trade, or rental of Social Security numbers without affirmative consent. And then there are three other subparts. One, an amendment to subpart 9 related to the refusal of doing business with someone who does not disclose their Social Security number to the business, and it prohibits that. So it prohibits a business from saying, I won't do business with you because you won't give me your Social Security number. And then it has some exceptions, namely, among them, if the business believes that that person really is an identity theft or is an identity thief. The fourth and fifth amendment to the existing law relates to the requirement of providing Social Security numbers over the Internet, and it adds to the current encryption requirement and adds that the Social Security number is essential to the transaction and is otherwise required or authorized by state or federal law. And then finally, it deletes a provision existing in the law that states that a company has no duty to determine whether the Social Security number is accurate that they've gotten from a third party. We believe very strongly that companies do have a reasonable duty of care to discern whether or not that Social Security number and the person that's asking for a loan, asking for an extension of credit, is the person who they say they are. But taking just a step back from the minutia of the bill, at the Attorney General's office, we are on the front lines of identity theft. And we believe very strongly that this bill goes a long way towards limiting the number of Social Security numbers that are floating out there that may ultimately result in identity theft. And we can go out and we can prosecute people who steal identities. And over the past few years, the legislature has changed laws to address identity theft and treat it as theft and treat it as a more serious violation of the law. But these provisions, this amendment, goes a long way at the prevention. It goes upstream to limit the number of Social Security numbers that gives the potential for identity theft down the line.
Thank you, Mr. Ireland. Mr. Wadsland, were you wanting to testify as well?
Yes.
If you please introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Benjamin Wadsland with the Attorney General's Office. I am the Assistant Director of Communications and Research. Previously worked in the Consumer Protection Division for several years, and as Mr. Ireland mentioned in the Attorney General's office, we are on the front line of the identity theft issue. We receive hundreds of calls per day from concerned citizens of Minnesota, and many of them deal with privacy issues and identity theft issues. This is a huge and growing problem in the state of Minnesota. As Representative Benson mentioned, we have nearly 10 million people in this country per year victimized by identity theft. And in the state of Minnesota, identity theft has been growing over the last 3 years. We saw a 20% increase from 2003 to 2005 based on figures shown by the Federal Trade Commission. And again, we believe that this bill goes far in addressing the dissemination of Social Security numbers out in the marketplace, buying, selling, trading Social Security numbers. And again, we believe strongly that this bill will do some very good things to limit that.
Thank you, Mr. Roxland.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Quick question. We're amending a bill that came on statutes in 206. Is this thing alive and well and working now that we're amending, or is this bill that you're amending, is it in effect right now?
Mr. Ireland.
Go ahead. The effective date was July 1 of 2007.
So the bill we're amending now, the bill we're amending now is supposed to go into effect in July 2007. So we are amending a bill that isn't alive yet.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Benson.
Representative, the issue has to do with the formulation of the bill before, in which it basically excluded those who might use Social Security number before. What date was it?
July 1st
of this year. So, in a sense, it excluded most organizations who may want to continue to use Social Security number in a way that this bill is attempting to restrict or to control more carefully. And also it would have led, as was discussed earlier, into having two groups of players here. Those companies and organizations who are now going to be using this new bill, which would be more restrictive than the provision that would allow companies in the past to carry on as they had before. So there would be a kind of a discriminatory aspect to keeping the law without an amendment. Is that
Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. That's well and good, Representative Benson. I'm just trying to get in my head that the bill we're amending doesn't start until July.
That's correct.
Yep, we're amending it now. I'm just trying to, that seems like an abnormal.
We're amending it in an effort to solve a problem which would occur if we did not amend it.
Mr. Chairman, so
Representative Peterson.
Just so I understand it, so the bill that was passed last year, which I understand was in the incubator for a couple of years, somebody didn't agree with it. So somebody's going to amend it before it even hits the deck. Am I stating that improperly?
Representative Peterson, I think Representative Benson has spoken to that.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, that would be correct, Mr. Representative Peterson. It was a flaw that was seen to make the bill nearly useless.
Representative Benson, excuse me, Nelson.
So this, Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, so this wouldn't be a lot different than a revisor's bill. We get these every year where a bill's been passed, it gets put into the laws, and they find minor mistakes or things. And this wouldn't be a whole lot different than a revisor's bill to just clean up housekeeping. You know, it's a mistake, or not a mistake, but a flaw they found in the bill that they're just trying to correct.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Benson.
Chairman, Mr. Nelson, that is correct.
Mr. Ireland, would it be fair to say with the exception in the 06 statute for those using Social Security numbers being exempted from that bill, using Social Security numbers up until July 1st of this year, did that set up a kind of a perverse incentive for companies to begin using Social Security numbers because they knew they would then be grandfathered in or grandfathered out of the statute?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. It's the equivalent of saying, as long as you rob my or start to plan to rob a bank before July 1, 2007, and you start taking those steps, then you're not going to be liable. But if you start planning and you actually break the law after July 1st, 2007, then we're going to hold you liable. So it does. It creates an incentive for companies it basically sends a warning bell that says, hey, if you're going to sell, if you're going to rent, if you're going to collect Social Security numbers, you better start before July 1, 2007. Otherwise, you're going to be on the hook.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Ireland, can you explain to me, I'm looking at the delete all amendment here, or not the delete all, the amendment here, but the section that says the business has a reasonable basis. Can you define for me what is a reasonable basis?
Mr. Ireland.
This amendment was put in after hearing industry concerns. And listening to their concerns on Wednesday, saying that there are circumstances in which they're talking with someone over the phone, or they get an application, or they get somebody who wants to do business with them, and they believe that that person is not who they say they are. And maybe the industry can address the specific point, but maybe the person who they're talking to is 20 years old, and the date of birth indicates that the actual person is 60 years old. So they have a basis to have some concern over whether or not this person really is the person that they're stating that they are. And under the law, absent the amendment, that exception, that business would be forced to do business with someone who they think is not who they are. And so they have a reasonable basis.
Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm interested in finding out is what will the Attorney General's office consider reasonable basis? You know, say it's a belief by the business that they truly feel. What kind of burden of proof will they have before you issue a fine because you don't feel that they used reasonable basis?
Mr. Ireland.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's difficult to say in the abstract or in a hypothetical situation. But a reasonable basis, when I look at it, enforcement actions, is whether or not there's some objective criteria that business used to believe that this person is not who they say they are. And if they have that objective criteria, whatever it is, then that choice is rational and reasonable.
With that, perhaps we should go to testifiers. Mr. Tennyson. Certainly. Please come forward and state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Mark Kulda, K-U-L-D-A. I'm here today representing the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. The Insurance Federation is a trade association that is made up primarily of the majority of Minnesota-based insurance companies and and the majority of the non-Minnesota-based insurance companies. But the Insurance Federation is also integral in the formation and the organization of a group that is known as the Fair Information Practices Coalition, which unfortunately has the acronym of FIPIC, not a very pleasant acronym, but FIPIC is a group that it pretty much spans the spectrum of the economy. It's made up of industries like the financial services industry, data industry, retailers, et cetera. There's about 40-plus members of FIPIC. And yeah, if you'd like, we'd normally have passed out a list of the coalition members. We do have a website, fairinformationpractices.com. If you go to the website and click on members, you can see who is involved with FIPIC. But if there's any one message that we want to really impart to you today is that we understand what the goal of this bill is, and really what the goal is to prevent identity theft. And we, in this industry, we share that goal with you. And when you think about what happens when identity theft occurs, It's a problem not only for the consumer, because they have to take a great deal of time extracting them from the process, but usually there's a financial loss as well. The consumer, because the federal law usually is protected. They only have to pay back a nominal amount of money. But the businesses usually take the loss on this. And when businesses take the loss in a crime like this, a company can either just agree to accept the loss and write it off, or they can spread the costs around to the rest of the economy. And so we all, as consumers, end up paying the price for this. So we really do have a common goal of trying to prevent identity theft. And I think our goal here today is to talk about what this bill perhaps will do. And our thoughts are that this bill may actually not do what you think it's going to do. It actually may make the problem worse by taking away tools that are important to us for preventing identity theft and fraud. And we'll show you that in more detail a little bit later. But one of the real purposes of the coalition, FIPA coalition, is to show that there is a very delicate balance in the economy today between protecting the rights of consumers and protecting them from identity theft and keeping intact their ability to conduct transactions that they have come to expect. And that really is the goal of FIPIC. And we do appreciate working with Representative Hillstrom. As she mentioned and Representative Benson mentioned, we did meet with the Attorney General's office and them on Wednesday. They did listen to our concerns. We're willing to go forth and continue working on some of the issues because we don't think the amendment does exactly what we were hoping it does. And we would like to have a couple of other groups today testify to tell you a little bit about that. But I do want to back up and tell you a little bit of history of the current law. The current law that we have in chapter right now was actually passed in 2005, and it, at the time, along with a provision in California, was seen as the toughest law in the country dealing with the use of Social Security numbers, and the 2006 bill actually added further protections. So we currently have the strongest law in the nation dealing with the use of Social Security numbers because in the 2006 session, I don't have exact details of this, but California actually scaled back their law. So we went to the same standard they had in 2005. In 2006, we upgraded our law. They scaled theirs back. We now in Minnesota have the toughest law dealing with this issue in the nation. We think that by adopting this bill, you are not going to add any additional consumer protections, and what you might do is actually take some of the tools that we have away from us in trying to prevent identity theft and fraud. And when you really look at the issue of identity theft, you have to determine what is the real problem. Is the real problem the use of Social Security numbers? And we would contend that it's not. That usually the most common perpetrators of this crime are people who actually know the victim, an acquaintance of the victim, friend, family member, coworker, that usually will have access to data anyway. And what we think would be a better solution would be to go after those people with stronger punishment. We don't address the issue of what do you do when you catch a person that is an identity thief. And I think if you made the penalties for those perpetrators tougher, that you might then send a strong message that you should not commit identity theft, and perhaps it will help in that regard. And the second issue is data breaches. That's obviously a topic of concern these days because we all hear about the loss of data. And I think what you find if you investigate and research the loss of data, and you hear many times about, you know, lost or stolen laptops, what you find is that people are notified when a laptop is lost or stolen, but in most cases, the data is not what is being sought after. It's because that a laptop is worth some money at a pawn shop, and the data on it is irrelevant. And so our point is that using this bill and advancing this bill doesn't do anything to help consumers. Actually, it takes some tools away from us. And I do want to go through just a few quick specifics, if you don't mind.
Please.
We do, at least in my industry, we are concerned about, on page 2, lines 2.25 to 2.30. This is a provision that would prohibit the mailing of certain forms and applications that contain Social Security numbers. In our industry, when you apply for a life insurance policy, for example, you fill out your policy and you sign the form, your number is on that, it goes to the insurer, but the insurer needs to send you a copy of your policy along with your application. So we're required to send that in the mail to you. We had brought this up on our meeting on Wednesday, and we would appreciate some serious thought into actually reinstating lines 2.25 to 2.30 because for some of the business that we need to do, we need to have the ability to send you your documents in the mail. And there might be some other groups here that would like to address that as well. We also, I would like just to make a defense of the so-called loophole that Mr. Ireland brought up. In the industry, we call this the continuous use exception, which was originally passed in the 2005 law. The one thing that Mr. Ireland didn't mention is that there actually is a consumer protection in the continuous use exception. If you read the text of the language, It tells you that you as a consumer need to be notified every year from the entity that your Social Security number is being used in a way that's inconsistent with the law, and that you as a consumer have the right to opt out of the use of that number. So even in the so-called loophole, there is a consumer protection that you as a consumer can say, I don't want you to use my Social Security number, don't, and the company then has to provide some sort of alternative. So the continuous use exception is important, but there are consumer protections in there for informed consumers to be able to opt out of that provision, and we would like to, if possible, see the repeal of the continuous use exception taken out and allow that to continue into law. One last thing I do want to mention, the Federal Trade Commission did report to Congress back in 2005, and I just have one quick statement I wanted to read to you from their testimony to the United States Senate Commerce Committee in May of 2005. And the statement was, without the ability to use Social Security numbers as personal identifiers and fraud prevention tools, the granting of credit and the provision of other financial services would become riskier and more expensive and inconvenient for consumers. That's the basic message here, is that the law that we have in Minnesota is already the toughest in the nation. We don't need to make it any stronger. I think Representative Peterson brought up a very good point. The law isn't even in effect yet. We don't even know what's going to happen until after July 1st. We've now had one attempt to make it stronger. This is the second attempt to make it stronger. Maybe we should see how it works to begin with. So, and with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Mr. Cole, many of us, is this our first walk in the park in this arena of consumer protection, so some of us don't even know the vocabulary, let alone the text. I had asked the question about when this thing was supposed to start in July of 2007. You sound to me like you made the comment it was 2005. Have you been involved in the conversations during the gestation of this thing? And can you fill me in? I'm trying to figure out why we're doing it now. If you guys, if somebody's been talking about it for 2 years, what's the pout here?
Mr. Colbert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, you know, the financial services industry has actually been involved in this issue since 1999, when the passage of a bill called the Financial Services Modernization Act, which we all know as Graham-Leach-Bliley, was actually adopted in 1999, went into effect a year or so later. And that very strictly regulates what we can do with personal financial information, including Social Security numbers. And so we've been paying attention to this issue for a long time, and I think we did make comments during the 2005 discussions, and one of the fallbacks we had was the continuous use exception. You know, financial service industry is heavily regulated by state and federal authorities. We have certain rules and procedures that we have to follow when we deal with the information. And, you know, we thought that with having the continuous use exception in law, with the consumer protections that are in it right now, that it would be adequate to protect and be able to allow us to do our business.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Peterson.
Let me reword my question a bit. Have you seen this text before? Was this text that we're talking about, these amendments now, were they discussed in 2005 and 2006?
Mr. Colbert.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Peterson, I don't believe these specific pieces from the bill that we see today was discussed in either 2005 or 2006.
Okay.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question that came to my mind as you were talking, you said, what, you're going to lose tools that you have now that to protect the consumers. What tools are we talking about that you're saying they're being taken away from you here?
Mr. Calder.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, we many times use for verification purposes and transmit data between entities to verify, and I think we are concerned with, if you want to look at the amendment on lines 1.6 to 1.9, and the word sell, lease, loan, trade, or rent an individual Social Security number unless there's been consent. There's many times that in the process of us trying to detect identity theft, we don't exactly want the person to know that we're trading information, trying to verify information, because they're not going to give us affirmative consent if we're trying to prove that they're a thief, for example. And we're a little worried about the terminology. They're vague terms. I mean, the word sell, lease, loan, trade, or rent, when you're talking about selling a car, it's pretty obvious what you're doing there. When you're talking about trading data back and forth, if you're giving some data to a vendor, they're processing it, maybe disposing of it, is that loaning them the data? Well, it could be. It could be. We don't know, because these terms aren't very clearly defined. And so we're a little concerned about that. We'd like to work with the AG's office and the author to see if we can work out a solution for that.
Representative Nelson.
I guess when I'm looking at this, I mean, I had some personal experience with this. My labor union used to use our Social Security number is their ID number. Right about the time California passed their law, actually a little bit before that, I was at a conference and I actually ran into the guy who was in charge of the computer system for the international, and I asked him, is there a reason, because members were always screaming at us about not wanting to give their Social Security number because identity theft was starting to become a problem. And I just asked him the question if there's a way to devise a system to eliminate that. Well, in the conversation, it was just, you know, he said, well, there's reasons why they can't, and or why it'd be difficult, and, you know, he put up a lot of these barriers why it wasn't feasible. And I went back from this conference, and a couple weeks later, I got called into the office of the head of the Carpenters Union here, and I got chastised, extremely chastised, for even bothering to ask that question. California passed their law. 6 months later, they changed the system, and everyone now has a unique identifying number, and the end of the world didn't happen, and we weren't prevented from being able to identify members and making sure dues get paid properly and all that. So I think you're throwing up maybe barriers that may not be here. I'm glad to hear that you're willing to work with trying to solve that problem, because I don't see that as a big problem. I mean, I've been through that, and it's the system's working fine now without using Social Security numbers.
Mr. Colton?
I don't have any response. Right. I think we do have some other testifiers doing.
Yes. Any other questions for Mr. Colton?
Thank you.
Mr. Tennyson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I have a little bit of a cold. My name is Bob Tennyson. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis with law firm Great Platt & Moody. And I have a long history, and I represent a company called Reed Elsevier, which owns LexisNexis and a number of other publishing companies. Privacy has been a major issue of mine for 30 years. 30 years ago, I served on the Federal Privacy Protection Study Commission as appointed by the U.S. Senate. It was a seven-member committee. We had a couple $1 million. We did our work and published a report, which is still a seminal work on personal privacy and information society. I also was a participant on behalf of the United States at the first OECD conference on privacy. I also was the author of the first privacy bill in Minnesota that became the Data Practices Act. Be that said, I appreciate the committee's indulgence and also the author's willingness to consider amendments and so on. But let me just kind of paint a broader outline. You're being handed out some executive summaries of surveys that were done by the Federal Trade Commission and also by the Better Business Bureau Javelin survey, which tries to quantify some of the issues and problems that we have. And these are how theft occurs, what's stolen, and so on, and how it can be prevented. The Social Security number is only a small part of a bigger problem. The criminal identity theft is a problem for individuals, businesses, and governments. It wreaks havoc with the victim's credit, financial reports, or financial accounts, employment, housing, education, peace of mind, and other matters. Major strides have been made by the federal government, state governments, and businesses and individuals to reduce the incidence of theft by enacting statutes, educating businesses and the public and individuals, providing better protections, and providing remedies to those who have suffered identity theft. Perhaps the most significant act in doing that is the Ramsey-Bailey Act, which you've heard about before. It provides protection for consumer financial information and requires institutions of security standards to maintain the security of the information in the hands of the entity. The Fair Credit Reporting Act, which has been around since the late 60s, provides significant protections and enforcement tools as well. You've probably all heard about the $10 million penalty the Federal Trade Commission imposed upon a company for a security breach because it failed to implement reasonable procedures to protect the data. This action was taken by the Federal Trade Commission under authority of the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act. The enforcement officials at the Office of the Control of the Currency, the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, also use the powers of the Ramsey-Bailey to enforce standards. And those are enforced very rigorously and are effective. The FTC undertook a survey of 4,000 citizens in 2003 to estimate the incidence of identity theft victimization, to measure the impact of identity theft on victims, to identify actions taken by victims, and to explore measures that may help the victims of future cases of identity theft. The handout I've given to you includes summaries of the FTC report and the 2006 annual report of the Better Business Bureau. Although the incidents of identity theft, according to those reports, have decreased in the last 3 years from 10.1 million people in 2003 to 8.9 million in 2006, it's still unacceptably high. We think the reduction has been achieved because of the millions of dollars spent by businesses to better protect information and by consumers being smarter and more circumspect about the protection of their own personal information. Both the FTC and the Better Business Bureau reports identify various means by which identity theft occurs. And I encourage you to take a look at that. Other attempts have been made to identify and quantify the means by which identity theft information has been improperly obtained. Although the methods by which the theft has occurred are categorized, the percentages of theft associated with each method are not necessarily, approximate. There's no way to verify all of the information provided. Common sources and methods include, for identity theft, the loss or stolen wallets, checkbooks, and credit cards, accessed by as part of a transaction when you go to a restaurant or something, friends, acquaintances, and relatives with access to the information, corrupt employees who have access to the information, stolen paper, mail, fraudulent changes of address, other ways, sometimes computer spyware, some taken from garbage, computer viruses and hackers, and emails sent by criminals posing as legitimate businesses or phishing. According to the 2005, I'm going back a year, 2005 BB Better Business Bureau study, of those who knew how their personal information was obtained, and not everybody does, the most common source of misused personal information by a factor of 2 to 1 is the lost or stolen wallet, credit card, checkbook, 28%, almost 29%. The second most frequent method was accessed by as part of a transaction, 12.9%. And I commend you to look at those surveys in detail. You can get them on the web. According to the FTC survey, in 26% of all cases, the victims knew who had misused the personal information, and in 9% of the cases, the victim identified a family member or relative as a person responsible for misusing the information. In the approximately 40% of the identity theft cases where the person knows the source of the theft, we go to the, you know, they know that's been obtained by the wallet, stolen wallet and so on, and also by friends, neighbors, acquaintances, relatives, family members, whatever. The survey also identified some misperceptions about data theft. One is that the perception is that consumers are helpless to protect themselves. I don't think that's true so much anymore. Many tools have been provided. In its survey, it found that 63% of fraud cases, the point of compromise was either theft by close associates of the consumer, since I just mentioned, lost or stolen wallets and so on. Consumers also detect half of their identity theft by monitoring their accounts, and as a result, they suffer less damage. Almost 11% of the fraud cases are caught by consumers monitoring their credit reports. And now, according to the survey, nearly 70% of consumers are now shredding documents, so trash is no longer such an important issue. The second misconception is that consumers bear the brunt of the financial loss. The average out-of-pocket cost of identity theft victims is $422, or 7% of the average fraudulent amount, which is $6,383. And that's down from $675 in 2005 and $555 in 2003. The rest of the loss is borne by the businesses, who have a great incentive to make sure that they minimize any ability of someone to hack into their system or obtain the information improperly. The third misconception is that the internet usage increases the risk of theft. According to the survey, the data compromised through the internet is statistically unchanged from 05, from 11% to 9%. Internet usage can also lower damages because electronic monitoring of accounts detects bad fraud faster. The fourth misconception is that seniors are the most frequent target of fraud operators. Generation Xers, ages 25 to 34, have the highest rate of identity fraud at 5.4%. The average fraud for this demographic, or average loss fraud, is the amount of fraud is $6,270 compared to the average fraud in the 65 plus category of $2,655. Also, the age group of 35 to 44 have the highest average fraud amount for the $9,000. The author, somebody asked a question about if this was the information raised in this bill were considered before. I haven't compared it to the earlier bill, but when we met with the author the other day, she said that this were the leftovers from the bills that were passed previously. And if that's the case, I would suggest the reason they weren't included is because they were inoperable or impractical and prevented things from happening. My client acquires public information. LexisNexis is a major collector of public information. And it provides that information to the government, to financial institutions, and to lawyers and other customers. Let me give you some of the reasons why it's done and what it what will happen if, if we're prevented from doing that. One is used by the federal government, and if you look in the last section of that handout, you'll find in tab 3 a little greater explanation of what it is that I'm going to talk about. First of all, it's used to prevent and investigate terrorist attacks. The federal government's a major user of our data. It's used to locate and recover missing children. And it's used to assist financial institutions in identifying and preventing fraud. Under the Patriot Act and others, financial institutions have an obligation to identify and know their customer. How do they know that Sarah Anderson is the Sarah Anderson she says she is? And anybody with a common name has the same problem. So you need to have more than just that person. And our through our sources of information, the public record, we can identify other factors that also help identify her or establish her identity. Lawyers use our services to locate missing witnesses. And when you're trying to find somebody who's on the run or hiding, it's not easy to do, but you do need to find them. It's also used in tracking down criminals for making arrests. In Florida recently, the government used our data to track down within a couple days somebody who abducted a child. They were able to do that because they have access to that information to find the person who they're associated with and so on. We also provide information to the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, which is part of the U.S. Treasury Department, for preventing and investigating financial crimes. We also use by government to find people and enforce child support orders. Another important factor as we get older is we have people who are entitled to pensions who can't be found, and this is a way to find them. We locate heirs and beneficiaries of trust and unclaimed property. We also are used to help locate blood, bone marrow, and organ donors contributing to important medical research efforts. We also notify families about hazardous and environmental hazards. And we use to track down and find unregistered sex offenders. The incidents, the bill as drafted, even as amended, would prevent us from doing those things. And those we think are significant societal values and benefits that we need to protect. And every company that I know of that's involved in collecting information is establishing strong standards for security of that data. The last thing we want to do is spend millions and millions of dollars to protect the data and have a breach. We had an experience with a company that my client bought a couple of years ago when they bought it, they allowed it, and they found that there had been some hacker trying to get in. Now, I've been to that facility, and you need 13 layers of security to get through it, but they had that app. And then what my client did, because there was potential for exposure, they notified everybody, provide free monitoring for a year. They had to set up a hotline to find for anybody to call. And when they whittled down to 300,000 or so names, it was about two or three people that thought they might have been actually accessed because of that. So it's just because somebody loses a computer, a laptop computer, doesn't mean the data is accessed. It doesn't mean there's a harm that's been done to the individual. So I think you need to look at what the potential damages are, exposure and so on, and what the realistic result is. So we're happy to continue working with the author and others, but I don't think the bill as drafted, even as amended, solves the problem. If you look at section...
One moment, please, Mr. Tennyson. Representative Peterson.
Well, maybe the testifier is going there, but I'm trying to equate the bill we're amending goes into place on July 1st of this year. You don't oppose that language. You're opposed to the language being amended for the reasons you're stating. I'm trying to figure the sequence out here.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Tennyson.
Representative Peterson, that's correct.
Mr. Tennyson, are there other testifiers you're wanting to bring forward today?
I think there are others here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tennyson, I did have one question for you. Sorry.
Sorry.
I think you run back. And this book is very helpful, and I think you've done a wonderful job. And I really enjoyed looking through the Better Business Bureau because I really believe that they're one of the organizations that does a lot for the community and for the business. I happen to be a member of the Better Business Bureau. And I think that you did a good job going through all this testimony as to how we've done a better job, except for evidently the young people, 25 to 34, are not in that group. But the one, when you get down to past that, the misperceptions, the first thing that the Better Business Bureau says is based upon the findings, this is the following tips for consumers. The very first tip is to prevent access to your personal information, and their number one bullet point is do not release social security or account numbers in response to email, phone, or in-person requests. So I'm wondering how you correlate some of this testimony with that fact. I mean, they're definitely saying do not release it.
Yeah, Mr.
Tennyson.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, we don't ask the individual for their social security number. But these are practical situations. For example, I had a call the other day. I had an email. It's called Wells Fargo. And I was wondering why they were calling me. I have a visa there. But so I called the number back, and I think it was a fishing expedition. When they asked me for my social security number, I hung up because that, you know, the bank wouldn't do that. And I think that people are careless. People have to learn. You have to, you know, the public has to become aware of all the ways that people can steal their information. And so I think not providing the social security number when you don't have to, excuse me, is fine. You know, a few years ago, I don't know how many years ago, the state was going to require the social security number as a driver's license number. I mean, there was a law passed that effect before people figured out that that wasn't such a good idea, and it was repealed. It was a common identifier. When I was in the Air Force, we had our ID number. And I can still remember it. That's the only way I get paid. But you know, now they went to the social security number, as I understand. So there's a lot of things that have happened with that, and when the social security number was set up, it wasn't supposed to be a universal identifier. Well, it's become that. We don't have anything else, and that's how you identify people to separate, you know, Neil Peterson from Neil Peterson or John Anderson from John Anderson. I don't know of any other way to do it, and because my client has sophisticated algorithms to try and identify and match and so on, but you still need something in common.
Anything else, Representative Scalzi? Thank you, Mr. Tennyson. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Joe Witt. I'm the President and CEO of the Minnesota Bankers Association. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. Minnesota Bankers Association represents about 460 banks operating in Minnesota, and we represent the smallest banks on up through the largest banks. And we obviously have a very strong interest in this bill, and I want to thank the authors for giving us a chance to work with them on this bill. We hate identity theft. As Mark mentioned earlier, it's a horrible situation for our customers to have to go through, and for us, we take the financial hit. So we hate identity theft, and we want to look at all the ways to reduce it. Restricting Social Security numbers in general is a good thing. We supported the efforts, and we do support the general concept. We supported the bills in 2005. And 2006, and we hope that we'll be able to get this bill into a shape where we can support it as well. But we do have some general concerns, because when you look at this issue, the devil really is in the details, and that's why we really appreciate the author working with us to try and work out some of those situations. I want to just mention one of the things that in an earlier piece of testimony, in a line of questioning, whether the bill being written in 2005 with an effective date in 2007 somehow gave businesses an incentive to set up their systems in order to break the law. From my standpoint, I can assure you the banks that we work with did not look at this as an opportunity to break the law when it was originally written in 2005, to set up systems now so they could somehow break the law. I think that's definitely off base. In fact, what our businesses did is, knowing that this thing was coming down and knowing that there was going to be significant restrictions on the use of Social Security numbers, they began immediately to implement systems to operate using different identifiers. So I think that line of questioning and the answer that there was somehow an incentive to break the law, I think that that mindset is a very unfortunate one, and I don't believe that it represents the vast majority of businesses operating in Minnesota. Representative Nelson's example of the union going to a different number, I really believe that the businesses in this state that have been aware of these changes are moving more toward other identifiers rather than trying to set up their systems to somehow violate this law. I think that's a bad way to look at our businesses in Minnesota. I want to say that we have supported, as I said earlier, the current law that's on the books. We have supported that law. We think it's a good way, and we're proud that Minnesota has the strongest rules in place for restricting Social Security number usage. And we do have a couple of things that we want to look at with respect to this amendment. We think there are some things that you should take into consideration as you consider this amendment. And first of all, we'd like to acknowledge the important changes that were made in the 07 amendment. These were very helpful in getting some of our concerns addressed with respect to House File 131. Having said that, there are still a couple of things that we'd want to discuss with you here today. First, in Section 8 of the Amendment 7. Mr. Chair, are we looking at the 07 amendment? Is it okay for me to address that?
Absolutely. And if you would cite line numbers, I think that might be
absolutely
simpler for everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm looking at Amendment 7, line 1.6 to 1.9, which is Section 8 of the bill that's in front of you, and also Section 8 of the amendment. The word that gives us a little pause, and one of the situations that I wanted you to consider, is where it says you can't sell the individual's Social Security number to a non-affiliated third party. There's one situation that we'd want you to be aware of, and I don't know if there's some way to craft an exception or something, but in the mortgage lending industry, a lot of times the lender that you're originally working with sells that loan into the secondary market. If you're working with a small mortgage broker or something that does not keep that loan, it sells it into the secondary market. Our question would be whether that would be a situation where the person is selling the number. They're not getting value for the sale of the Social Security number. They're selling a loan package in the secondary market. We would want you to just consider whether there could maybe be some language that could give our members some comfort in that situation. The second thing that I wanted to let you know that we're looking at very closely is, again, in the A7 amendment lines 1.16 and 1.17, the very last part of line 1.17, and such information is encrypted. We completely understand why you would want to add some kind of an encryption requirement in there. What this section is trying to do is get at the situation where somebody refuses to give a Social Security number to a business that needs it in order to do the transaction. Let me give you a little context on that from the banking world. Federal banking regulations now require that we obtain Social Security numbers basically for all of our transactions. In addition to the privacy stuff that we have on the federal side of things, we also have some customer identification procedures that are designed to ensure that our financial institutions know and understand who their customers are. These laws were originally passed as part of what's called the Bank Secrecy Act, where we are supposed to be sort of a law enforcement figure designed to catch anybody who's doing tax evasion, catch people who are terrorists. So we have laws in place that are designed to ensure that we know who the customers are. As part of those, we're required to collect Social Security numbers, whether it's a checking account, a CD, a loan, whatever. We're required by law to collect it. So we have the ability under this bill to refuse to do business with somebody if they don't provide us with a number that we're required to collect. If we do collect the data and put it onto our computer systems will likely encrypt that data. The concern that we have in this section is that we collect a lot of paper. A lot of our loan applications are on paper. Social Security number is written on there. Our paper that we collect to open up a deposit account has a Social Security number on there. Our question is, we have to retain those original loan documents just in case we have to sue the person or in case we're doing some fraud detection or something else. We can't deface those documents or it could hurt our ability to collect on the loans or whatever. So how do we encrypt paper when we can't deface those documents? I would just want to maybe have a discussion with the authors about how we can make that fit in a paper world. I understand how it works on the computer side, but we have record retention requirements for retaining those original documents. How does this encryption requirement, which is brand new in this amendment, how does that work in our paper-based world? I'd like to maybe have a discussion with the authors about that. And lastly, looking at the original House File 131, the language, and this is already something that's been testified to, the language on page 2, lines 25 to 30, striking the language in the notwithstanding clause there, that is something that was included in the original 2005 bill. It was something that we supported. It was retained in the 2006 bill. We supported that. We don't support striking it here in this bill in 2007. There's lots of situations where we're mailing information to other providers. For example, if you're applying for an FHA or a VA loan where you want a government guarantee as part of your loan, we're going to mail that loan package to the FHA office or the VA office so they can consider whether or not they're going to give you an FHA guaranteed loan. There's other situations where we're mailing documents to third parties in order for them to help us complete the transaction on behalf of the customer. So we do not support striking that language, and we'd like to continue working with the author to see whether or not, again, there could be either some exceptions that allow us to do our work on behalf of our customers or maybe some language that that could give us some comfort in that situation. Otherwise, we certainly support just not striking that language and leaving it intact. I'd be happy to stand for any questions that you'd have at this time.
Any questions for Mr. Witt?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Benson.
I just have a question to the witness. Other than these two items, the one encryption and the deleted section, you indicated the Bankers Association had supported the original bill in 2005. Since there have been a number of changes made, amendments which apparently are fit in a favorable light, how is it you were able to support the bill in 2005 but now feel that it is inadequate?
Mr. Witt.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, some of these amendments, specifically the ones that I spoke to, the three sections that we have major concerns with, are what give us pause in our support for the entire House file. I appreciate working with the author, and as I said earlier, some of the changes that were incorporated into the A7 go a long way to settling our concerns, and I hope that we can address the remaining three that we have so we can support this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hess. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce has about 2,400 members around the state, and we represent businesses in every segment of the state's economy. 80% of our members have fewer than 100 employees, and we are also affiliated with about 130 or so local chambers of commerce. So that gives you a little flavor for the businesses that I represent. We, too, appreciate the meeting that was held with the stakeholders by Representative Hilstrom, the Attorney General's Office, and Representative Benson to attempt to work out some of the differences that we have in the bill. While a few changes were made that address some of our concerns, there still are various problems, as you have heard from previous testifiers. Let me just make it clear that, as others have said, too, businesses do care about identity theft. And we worked, and other business organizations worked over the last 2 years, worked on and reached compromise on legislation dealing with security breaches, dealing with Social Security numbers, dealing with identity theft. And we did so while protecting legitimate transactions that our businesses, our members, need to occur to make the economy work. And the reason, this was alluded to previously as well, but the reason why some of the items I believe were removed from legislation in 2005 and 2006 were for that fact, because the business transactions could not take place, legitimate transactions, if some of these provisions would have stayed in the law. During our meeting the other day, we did ask why government entities are exempt from this proposal, and you can see that on line 1.7 of the bill. The response was something to the effect that, you know, government needs Social Security numbers to really complete many important transactions, you know, whether it's tax-related or otherwise. And I think that's absolutely correct. Businesses need them, too, to complete just as important transactions every day that consumers want and consumers demand. I think the real problem here is that the Social Security number is the only unique identifier that we have in this country. And because of that, you know, it's often used in critical business transactions that really have nothing to do whatsoever with stealing someone's identity. These are transactions, as others have mentioned, that are critical to whether it's getting a mortgage or protecting the public. And I'll skip over some of this that's already been covered.
Thank you.
But we think that requiring an alternative number in many cases would be costly to implement, couldn't be done immediately even if it was required, and more importantly, credit reporting is done on a national basis. So if we in Minnesota want to require some other identifier, I just don't know if it's feasible that companies around the nation will follow our lead. Some folks have mentioned a couple of the provisions, paragraph 8, the deleted language on lines 2.25 to 2.30. We agree with their comments. Part of the problem, I think, is some of the language is rather vague. It's already been talked about, what does it mean to loan or trade an individual Social Security number. We think that could cause some problems with transactions. On the amendment, it's already been mentioned on 1.18, what is a reasonable basis for a business to believe that the person is using a false identity? That could cause some problems. And on 1.20 and 1.21, if the business transaction cannot otherwise be completed, that too seems to us to be somewhat vague. It could, one person's impression of completing a transaction might be very different than the business's. Two other items I want to mention. First, the penalties. And I know this committee doesn't have jurisdiction over judicial penalties and criminal penalties, but they are very severe. They could add up to $25,000 fine per event, even per actually transaction or per violation, even if no harm was caused to the person. And second, there's also a lot of class action potential here that makes our members quite nervous. And then to Representative Nelson's earlier question about unions' use of Social Security number as an employee ID or employer, you know, some sort of identification number, on line 2.10 of the bill, it does say that Social Security numbers cannot be used as a primary identifier. And as we've said, this hasn't taken effect yet. So, you know, on July 1 of 2007, entities can't use Social Security numbers as the primary identifier. But the business, or in your case, the union, still has to use a Social Security number to complete many important transactions, whether it's transmitting data or dollars to federal or state governments, or dealing with pensions or health care and so on. So businesses have to have and have to use Social Security numbers to complete the various transactions that have been talked about by others. Mr. Chair, in summary, we are happy to continue to work with the authors and the Attorney General's office on this bill, but we do have significant concerns with some of the provisions that do remain. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hesse. Representative Peterson, one moment, please. For members in the audience, we have about 20 minutes left. We will take a vote on this today. We will adjourn on time at 11:30. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me ask you the question I asked the first one. Again, I understand this thing's been in gestation 05, 06. So my question to you, did you agree with the 06 result, and so your testimony is opposing the 07 proposed? And how strongly do you feel? Has the chamber ready to fall on its sword over this thing, or what?
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson, yes, we were among some of the groups that worked on previous legislation, and so the statute as it is today, it was a compromise of which we were one of the parties, a part of that. And I guess on the second part of your question, we'll certainly work with the authors and others in hopes of resolving the remaining issues that we have, but we certainly still have many concerns.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hesse, I guess, the point is, you brought up my story, but the point of that is they did this in 2003, I believe was when it was, they changed over because of the pressure from California law, and the world hasn't come to an end. I mean, there are things that they have to use a Social Security number for, but for a member identification number, they no longer do it. They can still transact business. They can still collect dues and stuff that they have to do without that number. So that was the point of my illustration, was the world doesn't come to an end because of that.
And Mr. Chair,
Mr. Hesse,
and Representative Nelson, and that's likely because they can still use the Social Security number to report important information to the various vendors or government entities that need it.
Representative Benson.
Mr. Chairman, I ask the witness here, looking at the amendment 106, 107, 108, where it says that we're not to use these Social Securities or numbers or disclose except required by authorized by law enforcement, by public safety purposes. And then down below in 120, business transaction can continue otherwise without, the person's Social Security number. Why doesn't those changes in this amendment address the concerns you just mentioned about not being able to send us information off to government, for example, since it is authorized by law that you can do so.
Mr. Hesse.
Mr. Chair, let me start with the second part. First, the refusal to do business with an individual that beginning on 1.10, it's my understanding that there certainly could be a difference of opinion among, say, the Attorney General's office or a regulating entity and a business of whether or not a transaction can otherwise be completed, you know, without the number. So it's again, we thought that was just a little vague. On the first part, the 1.6 to 1.9. The issue that was raised earlier on affirmative consent, it's not always possible to get affirmative consent in certain transactions, and maybe I'll have to defer to some others to address the other piece of your question.
Mr. Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd love to get a crack at this answer.
Here you go.
The Section 9 is a section that allows a business to refuse to work with somebody because they don't provide a number that is otherwise required. I think what we were talking about in the question that was asked was, in a transaction, day-to-day business, whether or not you can use and report using a certain number. If we have rightfully refused to conduct business with somebody under Section 9, it doesn't really get to the question of whether or not we're able to use or report to a law enforcement agency if we do business with somebody. And that's the difference, is that we need some comfort language, some language that gives us a strong sense that we are able to conduct the transactions, to report to the government agencies, and to use the Social Security numbers the way we are required and authorized to use it. Section 9 only deals with situations where we can rightfully refuse to do business with somebody. And I think that's the distinction that we need to draw. And that's why we are coming and asking for additional language that will clarify our rightful use of the number, not just our ability to say no to somebody if they don't provide the number.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. Representative House, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to dive into areas I probably shouldn't, and I'm going to ask Mr. Pender for help. It's difficult working with this bill when the author is not here, because I would ask the author if I could offer a verbal amendment, but I'm going to try. And the reason I'm using the amendment page just
thank you
to make it simpler for us. But on line 1.17, and I know that the banking industry was concerned about this, and I'm thinking after where it says, and such information is encrypted, and I don't know the proper way to do this, but get rid of the semicolon possibly and just insert if transmitted electronically. Would that make the banking industry comfortable when they sold a mortgage to another mortgage company, they'd have in their, he was talking about having the paper, and he couldn't encrypt a Social Security number on a mortgage application or a loan. But if we, with that language, but maybe this would help. And the reason I say that is because the original bill,
we do not,
or the bill we're working off, Hillstrom's bill, line 1.16 talks about transferring the number over the internet, and it says the connection is secure, the Social Security number is encrypted. So I'm thinking then over here we could say the same thing, that it's encrypted, but if transmitted electronically, that then allows them to keep it a paper trail if they have to sue somebody later. I rest my case.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Pender, I think somewhere in there was a question to you.
I would like to move a verbal amendment if the committee feels that will work, and if the banking industry feels that would work, and if the Attorney General's office would
feel that would work.
All right. Let's turn first to Mr. Pender just on the language question. Is that acceptable, Representative
Correct,
House?
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair, I think the amendment would be on line 1.17, after encrypted, insert if transmitted electronically.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Pender.
That would be my amendment. I would move that verbal amendment and then listen to the discussion.
Thank you, Representative House. Representative Benson.
There is another possible way of solving this. I think we could have a representative here from the Attorney General's office speak to it, but it may be possible that this amendment would be an acceptable one, or simply eliminating the phrase "and such information is encrypted," either of those two. But I would like to ask the representative from the Attorney General's office to speak to it.
Mr. Ireland.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The Attorney General's office would be amenable to just deleting "and such information is encrypted." I think that the electronic transmission of electronic information and the encryption of that information is dealt with elsewhere in the bill, and that would be a simple amendment.
All right. Going around the bend, Mr. Witt.
Mr. Chair, thank you. We would fully support striking "and such information is encrypted." The other thing that you should know, and I don't know if I testified to this or not, but banks are required to have security procedures in place to protect all data, whether it's in paper form or electronic. So I think the federal law already addresses the issues of making sure that we are adequately protecting data within our shop. So striking this will go a long way to helping address our concerns, and also just know that the consumer data will remain protected.
Representative Howes.
Mr. Chairman, then I would move a verbal amendment.
Can we withdraw your current verbal amendment?
I certainly could withdraw my first amendment. And then, Mr. Chairman, with the help of Mr. Pender, I think it would say that we would, on line 1.17 of the amendment to the bill, strike the comma and everything after the comma, and possibly insert a period after number.
Representative Howes, so moves. Mr. Pender, grammar check.
Mr. Chair, we need to keep the semicolon there because this is a list of things. So I think it should just be on line 1.17, strike, comma, "and such information is encrypted."
He says it much better, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, delete that language. Delete "and such information is encrypted."
Any discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Mr. Tennyson. I would, again, remind members and the public we're down to 8 minutes and 1 second.
Mr. Chairman, Members of the Committee, thank you. I just want to address Representative Benson's issue a little further in response to with regard to my client. I don't, you know, Section 9, or Clause 9 is really an exception. If you go up to the beginning, it doesn't address the need, it doesn't solve my client's problems at all. There's no, in terms of, I think what the amendment was offered to in Clause 3, or 9, small triple I, that standard is very vague, we're not quite sure how you would apply it. The second thing on the next, in clause, subclause 4, Roman 4, it doesn't work for us because of the way it's set up in you have to have somebody who's refusing to do business with you first, and that isn't the situation we arrive at. We don't do business with individuals. So in terms of the effort to try and carve out a provision for us so that we can continue to provide information and services for the reasons I spelled out in the previous testimony, document you have, this doesn't help us.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Tennyson. Mr. Anderson, are you wanting in on this?
Yes.
Please. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Buzz Anderson. I'm president of the Minnesota Retailers Association. I wanted to raise one other point, Mr. Chair, and I don't know if you wanted to finish this discussion with...
You may continue.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. One additional thing that I wanted to bring up, and I either need to ask the author or I need to ask Mr. Pender. I think most of the other points have been covered by the other witnesses. But one of the retail segments that I represent is pharmacy. And one of the very popular things for a lot of your constituents is Medicare Part D. We're required when you come to a pharmacy to establish that your identity and your qualification to be enrolled in Medicare Part D, and so we are required by federal law to collect a person's Social Security number. Now, I think that may be covered here in line 1.20 of the amendment, but I just want to again to seek Mr. Pender's advice on whether or not we're resolving that concern for pharmacy.
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't know if getting the Social Security number is required for Medicare Part D, but if it is, it seems to me that the language in 1.20 and 1.21 would apply to that then, and that it couldn't be completed without the person's number if Medicare Part D does require that.
Okay. Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Pender, and Representative Benson, I think our concerns are probably then covered. I would want to emphasize, though, that it is required by federal law that the pharmacy establish the person's qualifications, and the only way to do that is through getting their Social Security number. I would add one other point, and that is when Representative Peterson or someone other member of the committee goes to a Best Buy or a motorsports dealer and wants to have instant credit in order to buy a product or a vehicle, we're required to submit that person's Social Security number to a credit bureau to find out their eligibility for the loan. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is we want to make sure that the person who calls himself Neil Peterson is really Neil Peterson. Because I've actually met someone who's had their identity stolen and a loan was taken out, a mortgage was taken out, using their identity to buy a house by another person. Now, the other person is actually making the payments with their identity, but they can't find out who the person is because of privacy laws. So it's really important that if we're going to give you a loan or one of our affiliates is going to give a loan, that we make sure that it's actually the person that you're actually the person that you say you are. I think we're covered by the amendment here, but I just wanted to make that point. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And I thought the bow tie alone did the job on differentiating the Neil Petersons of the world. Representative Dietrich, for everyone, brevity is the soul of many things.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to address another of Mr. Witt's concerns, and that was on the 07 amendment line 1.6, the definition of sell. I think that he brought up a very valid concern for his particular industry is, does it mean sell the individual social security number, would selling the social security number be defined as be included in selling a loan package? And so I think that we want to clarify the definition of sell in this instance. And so Mr. Pender has been working on a verbal amendment, if the author would be consider it a friendly amendment.
You would.
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and members, I suggest on line 1.8, after the comma, insert necessary in connection with a transfer of a loan or other contractual obligation, comma.
Mr. Pender, would you repeat that for all of us interest, please?
In line 1.8, after the comma, insert necessary in connection with a transfer of a loan or other contractual obligation, comma.
Representative Dietrich, do you want to speak further to this amendment?
No, I don't. But I would like some input from Mr. Witt, see if that satisfies him.
Mr. Witt, there you are.
Mr. Chair and members, and Mr. Pender, I definitely like this. I think this is going to help us out a lot. I wonder if we could add a couple more words, Mr. Pender.
Go ahead, Mr. Witt. Let's see where we end up.
Not up to me.
Where it says, Mr. Pender, I respect you as a scribe so much that I'll always include you in the list.
I assume Representative Dietrich is listening as well.
Yes. Transfer of the loan, if we could have transfer or execution of the loan.
Sounds reasonable to me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dietrich?
It sounds reasonable to me also.
Right. Mr. Ireland or Representative Benson or either of you wanted to comment on this amendment? Mr. Ireland.
The Attorney General's Office doesn't have any major objection to the language change. However, the other contractual obligation does give me pause because there are lots of contracts that can be entered into by a whole variety of parties that are not tied to the transfer of a loan or the execution of a loan. And so perhaps without being redundant or repetitive, the language could actually be necessary to the transfer execution of a loan or other contractual obligation related to the transfer execution of a loan, so that we limit the scope of what that contract can be. I just don't want somebody to enter into a contract and claim that they fall under that exception when that's not what's intended, I don't believe, by the committee or the authors of the bill.
I think we're entering the sausage-making section of the legislature. Representative
Peterson. Back, huh?
Yes, back. Yeah. Representative Peterson.
Everybody can edit, Mr. Chairman. In number 9, we said, unless in connection with a transaction. Very simple. Why wouldn't we just go back up in 8 and say, unless in connection with the transaction, and just keep it really simple? I mean, we're getting into legalese talk. So if it's a connection with the transfer action, then it's actually the benefit of the consumer who's doing it.
Mr. Ireland, do you have a comment?
No objection to that language either.
Representative Dietrich, I'm going to throw the ball to you.
If Representative Peterson would like to submit that as an oral amendment, I will withdraw my amendment.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich.
I would offer it to Mr. Pender, and if he thinks it's appropriate, it would sure simplify it in my humble brain.
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson, I'm not sure. Could you repeat
that? Yeah, number 9, the last part of this is line 111. And they say you can refuse unless in connection with the transaction. And I think what I hear the bankers saying and everybody else on number 8 is you don't do it unless it is in connection with the transaction. If it's part of the transaction to sell, or to lease, to loan, to trade, to transfer, to encrypt, if it's part of the transaction, it actually benefits the consumer. I just use that same phrase in lesson connection on all of them, and then everybody knows what it is, instead of trying to isolate it to a special kind of
transaction
banking thing.
Representative Peterson, could you... Oh, Mr. Pender, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Nelson, excuse me.
Sorry to interrupt. Again, we're getting into the sausage baking and not being an attorney, and I I'm not on the next committee this is going to, but could we, would it be advisable to have the parties work on, you know, with Mr. Pender, with the author, look into this language, that because I all agree that this is a probably good language to put in there, and work on it so at the next committee, if it, they can work it out, the exact language, and make that amendment at that time?
I certainly see no harm in that. Mr. Witt, you seem to be concurring. Mr. Calda seems to be concurring. Anybody else want to get in on either concurring or opposing? Please introduce yourself for the tape.
Very briefly, Nancy Hilden on behalf of the Investment Company Institute. There is another example besides loans, and that is on mutual funds do transactions with third-party agents. And so it's a legitimate use, so it's a contractual obligation. So there are things outside of loans that could be have to apply, have this exception apply.
All right. Make my point. Connection with the transaction.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Peterson.
That's why it fit. The connection with the transaction fits and covers all those kinds of things.
At present, Representative Peterson, as I understand it, we have an amendment on the table from you. We also have what appears to be concurrence from the stakeholders to continue to work with Representative Hillstrom on this area and find the language that covers, that accomplishes the goal and covers things broadly. Do you want to pursue your amendment or withdraw it at this
point? No, I think I'd rather not pursue my amendment so I can vote no as a minority report.
Representative Peterson withdraws his amendment. Anyone else in the audience who wishes to speak either for or against House File 131? Seeing none. Any closing comments from committee members or questions? Seeing none. Representative Benson, do you have any closing comments?
I have none, sir.
All right. Given that, members, Representative Benson renews his motion that House File 131, as amended, be recommended to pass and be sent to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed?
No.
No. Motion prevails. With that, with apologies to staff, we will see you next week. This committee stands adjourned. Thank you, everyone.